Okay, welcome everybody who's either watching this live or listening to it after the fact. This is the fifth office hour session for the course Money Monopoly and Market Intervention, which is the third installment of Going Through Man, Economy, and State, and this is now November 2011. And we're in the office hour session. Okay, so Lewis has a good question. He says, given that as from tomorrow, the East Coast will be switching time zones from Eastern Daylight Time to Eastern Standard Time, will the scheduled time for our lectures remain the same? How can I put it? It will, so the lectures will always be based off of whatever the people in New York City are doing, if that makes sense. So, yes, if you're on a spot on planet Earth where you don't ever change your clocks, then from your perspective, the lectures in this course will move because the people in New York City are going to move, and I'm on Central Time, but I'm linked to the daylight savings, so I'm going to move too. So I think for most people that are taking this class that are in the United States, their time's going to shift. And so to disrupt it as little as possible from their perspective, that's why we're shifting. So yeah, and that's why also I always say in the emails and stuff, if you've noticed that, I don't say Eastern Daylight or Eastern Standard. I just say Eastern Time to try to avoid confusion. I just mean whatever time it is in New York City right now, you know, that's what we're taking is gospel, and then, you know, we adjust accordingly depending on where you are. So yes, if you are in a place on Earth that does not move your clocks, then you will see a 1 hour change from your point of view. But thanks for telling me that, Lewis. I'll send an email out because that's always going to screw people up. It's really amazing how weird it is to do this, and that's why I'm always with the quizzes. I always warn people, just do it the night before. Don't wait till you think the deadline is, because there's like three different adjustments people have to make sometimes, whether it's, you know, their time zone, like when does the quiz actually turn off, and then is there daylight savings time or not. All right, so let me just jot a note to myself. Thanks for bringing that up. Okay, any other questions? Got a few people logged in here. Presumably you're all pros at this, but if not, let me just say, as I always do in these office hour sessions, go ahead and type your questions right into the chat box. And if you don't wait till I wrap up my answer to one question, if you have another question, go ahead and type it, because then that's how I regulate the speed with which I answer them. All right, well, what you guys are thinking, maybe I'll go off on a tangent on Eastern Daylight Time and all that stuff, but by all means, this is not pertinent to Rothbard's book, so if someone has a question about Rothbard or something or Austrian economics, go ahead and post it. But anyway, since you guys aren't posting anything, the very idea, you know, what is this daylight savings time, in case you're from a place that doesn't do it? Well, it's in the U.S., I think they did it nationwide during one of the world wars. My first hunch is to say World War II, but for some reason, I think they did it earlier in World War I. But anyway, I'm pretty sure they did it during one of the world wars for efficiency purposes, right? Because like some engineer or something pointed out that, if the season changes, and as the, you know, the number of hours during which there's sunlight shrinks, you know, if we end up using more kerosene or electricity or whatever, because just, you know, and so what if we just shifted the day an hour one way? Well, then look at all these savings we would get in terms of efficiency, and that would be good for the war effort. And so that's why they did it. So it's kind of crazy, just the hubris of you know, the central planning mentality that, oh, why don't we just change time itself, because we can do that because we're the government. We can get everyone to do it. So anyway, there have been studies done to show the costs of doing that, and it's crazy stuff. Like, because it messes with people's bodies, right? That you're on the time when you, set the clocks ahead, so it's spring forward. So in the spring, when you take your clock and you think it's 3 p.m., but you change it to 4 p.m., that usually messes with people, because usually they lose an hour of sleep. I mean, in theory, it ought to balance over the course of a year, but of course, what really ends up happening is on that night you lose an hour of sleep, and then on a different night you gain an hour of sleep. But so what happens is people are all messed up biologically, and they can document. They've done studies to show that there's a lot more traffic accidents on the day or the week after people switch the clocks ahead, because everyone there, or there's more heart attacks. And so it's stuff that you would, and they also, economists try to quantify and say just the cost of doing that besides deaths and traffic accidents, but also it's a pain to have to go change all your clocks. Like, it takes time to do that. And you might say, okay, what's the big, but if 300 million people or however many households there are have to do that twice a year, well, that starts adding up. And so, no matter what, even if you just put a little tiny number on what's the value of my time in minutes or something, well, you multiply that by, 100, 200 million people who have to do it twice a year, and that's a decent chunk of change. So it's, and then the other thing too is, it's not even obvious that it saves energy, because I'd have to go look up the thing, but it's, like, the mechanism that they thought back in World War II or whenever they put it in, it may have been true back then, but since the way we use energy has evolved since then, at this point, it's not even clear that daylight savings time saves energy, which was part of the ostensible reason. So I think now the main reason people cling to it is they think that it helps, like, when kids go to school, that they don't want to be like pitch black in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, when some kids have to be waiting on this corner to get picked up by the school bus. And so by doing daylight savings adjustments, it might make it lighter at that time of, or not that time of day, it might make it actually later in the day when the kids are doing that. So this is the rationale for it, keeps adjusting, but it's the kind of thing where, well, gee, we've been doing it now for so long, how could we stop? Okay. Costco Dragomir says, this is my first course in economics. Let me stop for a second here. When you guys post these things, it's not a big deal, because I'm going to read it, and I think everyone's going to be able to see it eventually. But when you type in these office hour sessions, when you type in your message, there's like a little pull-down menu that says send to, and you want to – let me see what the options are. I think you want to make it either like all attendees or all participants. Okay, so don't just send it to me, because you want other people to be able to read your question. Unless you're sending me a personal message, like you really think I'm good looking or something, then keep that private. Okay, so he says, this is my first course in economics. I am an engineer. I have done my fair share of mathematics. I am kind of shocked of the gross assumptions the economists use in their mathematical models. To put it mildly, I would not drive over a bridge built by an economist. That's pretty good. Apparently, the Austrians spend a lot of time just refuting Keynesian's bad mathematics. What is the place of mathematics, if any, in the study of economics, in your opinion? Okay, that's a really good question. Let me think about it for a second. So first of all, you're totally right, and it really is shocking. So let me just talk a little bit about that, the use of mathematics in higher economics, formal economics, professional economics, you want to call it that, because I think I understand what happened, All right, and so it's when you're, if you as a, as someone from a different discipline or as a young budding Austrian economist, if I handed you the latest journal of formal economics, you know, like the American Economic Review or the Journal of Economic Theory, you know, some of those top ranked journals, and you flip through it, you would be able to understand the abstracts, but then after that, you probably wouldn't understand anything in the article. And because it would just be all, it would be a model that you wouldn't be able to even follow, and the equations would have all kinds of literally be like Greek letters and stuff like that. So, and even the logic behind the models wouldn't strike you necessarily as the kind of economics you normally do. So it wouldn't even just be like, oh, that's economics, but they say it in math. It would be like what they were doing with the math economically wouldn't make any sense to you if you could even decipher what they were doing. So it's interesting to say, well, how the heck did that happen? And so, and I think because I went to NYU to get my PhD, and I graduated in 2003, so I think I have a decent grasp of what mainstream economics does and then how it got to that position. So the Paul Samuelson is probably like if you wanted to blame somebody, he would be the guy, the one person who's most responsible for that, because economics used to be literary. If you go read the classics from the 1800s, John Stuart Mill and stuff like that, economics was mostly, it was all words. Then with Walras, he was the one who started bringing in mathematics to it. But still, even the classics, like in the early 1900s, like Alfred Marshall and stuff like that, even Irving Fisher, who is, who was very mathematically inclined and so on. I mean, his seminal works, like on interest and so forth. I mean, they would write their stuff and have the mathematical appendices. I mean, I'm generalizing, but that's okay. So it's still that they thought the economics was a logical discipline, and then maybe for some readers you could illustrate the stuff with equations, but that was really just a matter of precision in their mind, that they just because words could be a little bit confusing or vague, and so they thought, okay, let's just be crystal clear with the math, and then that process just kept evolving. And like I say, Paul Samuelson was the one who, he had a very quick mind and was he was widely read. So Samuelson had read a lot of math and read a lot of physics and was real good at proving things in terms of, making a list of assumptions and then reaching conclusions deductively from them. And so he was the one who really started, just did his economics that way, or at the formal level, for journal articles, for peer review. And, so he would introduce, well, we could have a utility function. And instead of talking about people's ordinal preferences, what if, we have a function U that takes as an argument the list of goods that the person consumes, and then it assigns a unique real number to that vector, and then what are the properties this utility function would have to have such that it represented their preferences? Okay, so he's doing all kinds of stuff like that, and then under what circumstances do we know an equilibrium would exist? The people in this community all had utility functions, blah blah blah. You do all kinds of stuff like that. So it was real neat, the stuff that Samuelson was doing, and it looked really smart and impressive, and most importantly, it looked scientific. That the economists thought that, oh, okay, what Samuelson's doing is rigorous. That there's no doubt in our mind if he submits a theorem, because that's what they were, he was doing theorems. he submits a theorem to a journal, you know, and the referees can look at it and they can be pretty sure that it's right. Whereas when we write stuff in words, you know, maybe we're smuggling in assumptions that we don't know. And so the thing, maybe the way to understand it is, if you read right now economics bloggers and how they argue about stuff, 90% of it is they're talking past each other. And it's really hard to even pin somebody down. I mean, even more than 90%, I think 95% of what I'm arguing with on my blog with people, especially if I'm talking about other economists who are Keynesians. I don't mean like just, you know, guys in the comments that may take pot shots at me or something, but I mean other professional economists who think, you know, there ought to be government stimulus or whatever, and we argue back and forth. It takes a long time just to get to what are we even arguing about, and that's because we're using English words that we mean slightly different things, and it just takes forever. Whereas if we were arguing over a mathematical model, then it wouldn't take long at all. Like very quickly, we would know what we were talking about. And you know, I'd say, oh, I'm 9-4 here, where it says the production function is concave. You know, are you sure you want to say that? You know, does that really imply this? And, you know, it would be like a question of math, and it would be objectively true or false, you see? So that's why I think economists went that route, is because they wanted to be very precise and wrong as opposed to being real vague and correct. That's not the way they would describe it, of course, but that's the way I'm describing it, that they knew the assumptions they had to make in these mathematical models were false, that the real world doesn't obey these assumptions, but let's at least have this nice little self-contained model that we know everything about, and we can be totally sure about the results in this world that we're imagining of this simple model. And then, you know, we can wonder, do those results spill over into the real world? But at least we know what we're talking about with this model. There's no ambiguity. And once they went down that path, it was hard to pull away. So as far as with the place of mathematics, it depends how broadly you mean by the concept or the term economics. So in terms of economic principles, I don't think, or you know, if you want to talk about economic laws, I don't think mathematics is useful at all. I mean, you sometimes might, but then moving beyond that, you use math a little bit. Like for example, if I'm teaching free trade, and I want to teach comparative advantage, it's true. You know, the principle itself is a verbal one, is a logical one. But you know, when I'm trying to get that across to people, it's hard to not use a very simplistic mental model to get that principle across, where you say, okay, well, suppose there's just two countries, and you know, one country makes wine and sweaters, and the other country makes sweaters and wine. And initially they don't trade with each other, and then they start trading with each other, and here are the numbers. And you see what I'm saying? Like, it's very easy to illustrate the law of comparative advantage with these little simple scenarios that involve numbers. Even though you could say, wait a minute, the real world has more than two countries. And you could say, yeah, I know, but that's real complicated. I'm trying to just show the principle with this little thought experiment. All right, and the same thing too, like in man, economy, and state, when we're trying to show how, you know, what's the relationship between the prices of factors of production and at different stages in the ERE, and we have that, you know, that diagram. I don't know if you were with us for that class, but you know, the diagram showing the high order goods and then the value of the product increases over time until it reaches the consumer, and that's 100 ounces of gold at that point. And we just walk through all that and say, oh, the interest rate's 5%, and so what do we know about the factor prices and then what they're going to sell for next year, blah, blah, blah. I mean, that is a very specific, unrealistic model of a hypothetical little economy. There's all kinds of assumptions we had to make just to set that thing up. And then, but you know, you ask us, so why are you Austrians doing it? Why did Rothbard have this ridiculously unrealistic model of an economy in his book? And you say, well, because he was illustrating some principles about, you know, the relationship of time preference to investment and blah, blah, blah. So I'm just saying you have to be careful as an Austrian, because in one sense we do that stuff too. It's just we think we do it the right way. And so I'm not saying that Rothbard is a hypocrite or that he's violating his own methodological prescriptions, but I am just saying keep in mind, you know, that there is a sense in which Austrians also make, you know, use models and they have unrealistic assumptions, and then there's numbers that go into the models that, you know, it wouldn't be enough. How can I put it? Rothbard's description there of the capital structure in the ERE, and then when he wants to discuss a change in time preferences, if he did that whole thing without using any numbers, it wouldn't be nearly as informative. You need to have numbers in there to see how it is the one way, and then to see what happens if it changes. If he just talked generically about, let's, you know, originally suppose the time preference is something, and then the relationships would be this way, and he could make a bunch of true statements, and then he said, now suppose time preference goes down, but he doesn't say what it was originally, and he doesn't say what it was before, and he just says the interest rate now would be lower. I mean, what he said would still be true, but without plugging in numbers, it would be hard for the new student to really see it, and it helps a lot of times to see a number. The same thing, like I say, with comparative advantage. There's no way anybody would understand comparative advantage if you didn't give a numerical example to show, okay, in this little simplistic world where there's just two countries and two goods, and workers in both countries are equally good at both occupations, what would happen if, you know, originally there was a full, you know, ban on trade, and then you lifted it and allowed free trade, what would be the two equilibria? And then look at how the people in both countries are better off if you allow trade. So without giving a numerical example like that, I don't think anybody would really see it. You could say the principle in words, but you need to see that illustration. So that's, I think, what mainstream economists are actually doing with these things, is that they're just coming up with very formal, rigorous illustrations of stuff that maybe they think is what's going on in the real world. So it's the problem is they, I think, don't understand or don't remember the limitations and the assumptions of the model. But they start believing the model is real. And the just a classic example of that is this guy Scott Sumner that many of you may know, that I argue with my blog a lot, that he's one of the leading proponents of having the Fed and other central banks target a growth level path of nominal GDP. So the idea is right now the Fed says, okay, GDP next quarter, next year, we want it to be at this number, and then the next quarter, we want it to be at this number, the next quarter this number, and so if it falls short, then the Fed has to inflate more to get back up to where it was supposed to be. And that's by the same token, if it overshoots, then they need to tighten until so it grows more slowly to get back on that originally projected level path of what it was going to be. So when you talk to Scott and you read his blog, I mean, it's clear he now sees the world through that lens. And not only that, but he thinks everybody else looks at the world the same way. So he'll say ridiculous things, in my opinion, like, why did the financial crisis intensify in the fall of 2008? Because investors and firms all of a sudden thought that the Fed wasn't going to maintain the growth rate of nominal GDP the way it had earlier. And he'll even say the growth rate of NGDP. And I'll say, Scott, I'm sure not more than 2% of the people you had in mind back then would even know what NGDP stands for. And you're telling me the financial crisis occurred because they were worried about what the Fed was doing with respect to NGDP? What are you talking about? That's crazy. And, you know, then he comes up with, well, no, but if one firm's worried about, you know, his income, then collectively, if all the firms are worried about their own incomes, and you put it, you aggregate it, then that means by hypothesis, you know, that they're all worried collectively about nominal GDP. You know, so he'll do stuff like that, but it's just, I'll say, okay, well, then you can talk like that. Say the firms are worried about their own income, and then in the aggregate, that means such and such, but don't just say the firms were worried about nominal GDP not growing, because they weren't. That's a false statement. They were not worried about nominal GDP. It, you know, that'd be like saying Isaac Newton was worried about quarks, which you could say, given our modern understanding of the physical world, Isaac Newton, when he talked about stuff, was really talking about quarks. But no, Isaac Newton was not talking about quarks. He didn't even know what a quark was. And that's the kind of stuff that Scott does all the time. And he just, you know, I think illustrates it more than, or epitomizes it better than others. So that's, so I don't know if I'm answering your question, but one other thing too I'll say, Kostla, is you're right. What's funny is economists think they're being real rigorous and scientific, but when people from other disciplines that really are mathematical, when they look at the stuff that economists do, they're amused by it. So for one thing, economists really aren't that good at math. Economists are better at math than sociologists are political scientists, but they're not as good at math as engineers or physicists and or mathematicians. And so, you know, when, like I say, when the, there were these guys in my grad program that were, they got stuck and they were doing their dissertation on something, and they just got stuck at some point. It was a purely mathematical roadblock. You know, just the model they had set up, and they knew what the equilibrium was supposed to be, and they were moving through it, and they were trying to prove something, you know, some property of an all equilibria of this type, such and such happens. So since they're using the language of math, they had this, what they needed to happen was a mathematical move. You know, they wanted to be able to say, from these assumptions, can we prove this conclusion? And they couldn't do it. They couldn't figure out how to get from there, you know, from here to there. And but they thought it was true, but they just couldn't figure out how to prove it. So they just walked. So we're at NYU in the economics building, and they just walked across the street to the guy in the math building, you know. So because the economy, their advisors and stuff, the economists, they couldn't do it either. And they said, go across the street to the Courant building, with, you know, math. The NYU had a famous school of mathematics. And so they went over there, and the guy looked at it, and, you know, like 10 seconds just went and solved it. He, you know, jotted some stuff down, and then I think, like, he even was going to throw that out in the garbage, like, thinking they got it. And they were like, no, don't throw that out. You know, it was kind of like that from that Matt Damon movie when he starts burning the theorem. So, I mean, it's, you know, that kind of stuff is funny, that the economists who are really into this math stuff, you know, they pride themselves, and, oh, we're being so rigorous, but they're actually not really good at math. And the other thing too is what they're doing actually is, and this is, I think this is largely because of Paul Samuelson, is they're actually, economics now is largely patterned after classical mechanics. Right, so the differential equations that illustrated the Newtonian, and then also the laws of electromagnetism and stuff in physics that prevailed, let's say, at the end of the 1800s, you know, before special relativity and before quantum mechanics came onto the scene. And that's really the, you know, when we have these fancy mathematical economic models, you know, it's not cutting edge stuff. They're actually just patterned after the way physics was in the late 1800s. And then now, you know, some people are trying to update it and do things, but it's just funny. And also, too, the way, you know, an economics journal article, like I said, it consists of a bunch of theorems. So it's actually not really physics. It's more like math. And, you know, because if you look at, you know, journals like Nature or Science or something, you know, where they actually publish cutting-edge natural science research, like chemistry or physics or whatever, it's not nearly as rigorous as the economics articles are. It's more loosey-goosey, and it's just funny that it's, you know, I think the economists believed they were being like physicists, but they actually weren't. That they were, you know, they were just doing this hyper refined stuff to go, oh, we're so sure that we're correct because we have our assumptions spelled out, and then we, you know, logically deduce the results. Where, because in physics, of course, you're using induction. You can't prove anything in physics. It's not a list of assumptions and then here, you know, you can have a model, but then, you know, that's part of it too, that the economics spend, the mathematical economics, they spend a lot of time developing the theoretical model and not really much time to say how well does this model match up with reality. Whereas in physics, it's not like you've got all these people who spend all kinds of time saying, okay, these are the assumptions of the theory, and then what conclusions could we spin out of it? I mean, you do have a distinction between theorist and experimenter, but not the same way you do in economics. And like I say, I think a lot of economists believe, oh, we're being empirical scientists just like the physicists, but in practice, if you look at the journal articles, they're totally different. Just the style is different. You guys got any other questions? I've been talking about this one for a while. Well, until somebody posts something new, let me just pontificate on this a little bit more, but by all means, if you have something else to ask, go ahead. Let me come back to a point I made. I said it's not merely that they use math. It's that doing that, because they think in terms of mathematical models, that influences the way they think of their economics. And so, for example, the best example I can give you, what Costell, if you haven't read it, hang on, let me find something for you. Because it's, first of all, Costell, I don't know if you knew this, but Roger Garrison was an engineer first, and then he switched over to economics. And he has a great line that he has. I think he's written it up before, but he said it, he I think won some award or something the last time I was down in Auburn and he gave a talk. In case you don't know, Roger Garrison is one of the leading macro economists in Austrian economics. So he had those really neat PowerPoint demonstrations of Austrian business cycle theory. And he's very good at translating the Hayekian framework into language that mainstream economists can understand. So Roger Garrison is a great guy if you've got like sympathetic mainstream economists who want to say, yeah, I can't read human action, it's too big, but what are you guys talking about when you talk about your Austrian business cycle theory? Roger Garrison is a great guy to point them to. But anyway, he said, I'm looking up something in case you're wondering why I seem absent-minded here. He said that what I'm looking for is, when I was in grad school, I wrote something up for Mises.org to summarize the difference between mainstream economics and Austrian stuff. And so I think, Costell, if you're coming to this, oh, here we are. Okay, so I'll give you this. But anyway, what Roger Garrison said is that because he started out as an engineer and then came into economics, he was more able to separate the math from the economics. Whereas he said, if you people, you know, students who from the beginning just went right into economics, by which he meant, you know, mainstream economics, they didn't really have a chance because they learned economics as they were learning all this high-powered math stuff. And so they kind of thought, oh, that is economics. Whereas, you know, Garrison, because he'd been trained as an engineer, you know, he understood differential equations and things like that, and he understood how, you know, so he could see what was what. Because that's the problem is when you let me say this too. The people who are, you know, at the top schools who are teaching mainstream economics right now, they are really smart. So don't ever fall into the trap of thinking, oh, these guys at Harvard, MIT are a bunch of idiots. No, they're not at all. And if that's what you're thinking, you're going to get all screwed up because you're not accurately diagnosing what happened. Those people are super smart. I mean, they're smarter on average than most of the Austrians. And I'm not saying the Austrians are dumb. I'm just saying, you know, how do you get to be a professor at Harvard in a hard topic like economics is you have to be really smart. In terms of you have a sharp mind and you know you can think of things really quickly and so forth, and you have a powerful mental abilities. Of course, they deploy it wrong, but that, you know, they have very quick minds. And so if you go in there and you don't know any better, you're going to be blown away by, oh wow, these guys are really smart. Look at how rigorous their stuff is. Oh, we're so much more rigorous than the sociologists and the historians and whatever. You hear in economics, we can be dead sure of what we're doing. And if you don't like somebody's model, well, then you just tweak the assumptions and you make a different model, you know. So that's the thing. So anyway, let me just finish this one anecdote because someone else asked me a different question. So I just posted this article called An Austrian in Grad School Confronting the Mainstream. So for those of you who are just listening to this and you don't have access to the chat box, if you're curious, just go ahead and Google that. It's in my archives at Mises.org, or if you just Googled Robert Murphy, an Austrian in grad school confronting the mainstream, it'll probably pop up. So there I went through and just really laid out when I was first in grad school, and I put my finger on the way that mainstream economists do their economics compared to the Austrians. Because it's not simply that, oh, the mainstream guys use math and the Austrians use words. That is true. But it's a lot deeper than that. So let me just give you one quick example. We would do, on one of my first tests, there was a question that said, okay, suppose there's a guy all by himself on this island, and there's a tree that gives off fruit every period, and, you know, the guy's utility function is such and such. You know, so he has time preference in there and everything. And the tree, let's say, you know, he can't plant more fruits or anything. It's just all he can ever eat each period is how much fruit the tree shoots out. And he can't save the fruit. You know, it'll rot from period to period. So the tree shoots out a certain amount of fruit. There's nothing else on the island that he can use his labor to construct. So every period, you know, so they construct deliberately so that every period all he can do is eat the apples or oranges or whatever it is that shoots off this tree, and he can't save or invest or do anything else to change his future consumption. He's just at the mercy of eating whatever this tree shoots out every period. And then the question was, what is the equilibrium interest rate in this world? It's just this one guy, and there's no production, there's no saving or investment, he's just eating this. So that question is baffled me, and I'm staring at the thing like, what the heck? I didn't even understand what they meant. Because if an equilibrium interest rate, I mean, how could there be an interest rate if there's no one else to trade with? What does that even mean? And I was just totally confused. And so I just put down, you know, one divided by his time, it was beta, was his time preference discount on future utility. So I just said, well, you know, hey, time preference has to do with interest rates, so I just did that. So, you know, more his time preference would be the higher the interest rate or something like that. And so, you know, it was 1/beta. And that was wrong. What they wanted you to do was to say, oh, well, in equilibrium, we know this guy has to consume all the fruit each period. So imagine a hypothetical market where he thinks he has the ability to buy or sell present goods against future goods at, you know, the real interest rate. And then what does that number have to be such that, given his preferences and his expectations of how much he's going to be able to eat in the future based on, you know, whether this tree is shooting out more or fewer apples in the future, what do those numbers have to be such that in equilibrium he maximizes his utility function by just eating the fruit that shoots out every period? And so he doesn't want to try to trade away any, or he doesn't want to try to borrow fruit now and pay it back later. And that was, you know, so that's what you were supposed to do. So now, after having gone through the program, I understand that mentality, and I see why that would be useful in different applications, you know, where you say, oh, there's the invisible hand, and market prices have, you know, market prices have to guide people to do things, given what real resources are and constraints and so on. And so, you know, there is a sense in which if you know something has to happen in the aggregate because of some physical constraint, well, then market prices have to adjust so that people individually do that. You know, like if there's a drought and the amount of apples goes way down, you know physically people have to eat fewer apples. So in a free market, what happens? Oh, the price of apples goes way up until the amount that households voluntarily want to buy exactly equals now the much smaller stock. You know, so there is that idea or that intuition. I get that, but just like I say, the way they phrased the question was, there's a guy all by himself on this island with this tree shooting on fruit. What's the equilibrium interest rate? That made no sense to me. So that's the kind of way they think of it. And so that's one aspect of it, is that they think largely in pinning down various equilibria mathematically. And so they think in terms of equilibrium states, whereas, of course, for the Austrians, it's more, you know, they more think about what is the equilibration process. You know, how does the market work? How does entrepreneurship work? So that if there's a change, you know, what forces get set in motion to restore the equilibrium, as opposed to just almost exclusively focusing on what is the equilibrium here. Okay. Let's see. Costell says, has there ever been a time period when there was no practice of fractional reserve banking or something equivalent to it? In other words, has the Austrian model ever been checked empirically? Sorry, but I don't know. I haven't really delved into that so-called free banking literature, and I don't know. I mean, I shouldn't even say. So, I know that, like, guys like George Selgin or whatever, like, they argue about what happened in Scotland over a certain period in Rothbard. You know, so Selgin and those guys think that there was basically laissez-faire banking for a period, and it worked great, and there was fractional reserves, whereas Rothbard and I think Salerno looked at that. They said, no, that your analysis is wrong because of X, Y, and Z, and I don't know the debate well enough, so I can't tell you. Jeff Leskovar says, every now and then I read that the Fed produced $16 trillion during the 08 crisis. What are they talking about? The Fed balance sheet didn't get anywhere near that big. Yeah, that's right. Good point, Jeff. It's the $16 trillion seems like a big number. Well, what happens is the Fed, and I'm not endorsing that $16 trillion number, but part of what happens is the Fed would make short-term loans to various investment banks. So the Fed might come in and say, okay, Citibank, we'll give you whatever, a 30-day loan of $1 billion, and then you give us as collateral those mortgage-backed securities that no one in his right mind would buy from you at anywhere near par. But we'll give you $1 billion in reserves, and you just pledge as collateral so-called $1 billion of your mortgage-backed securities, even though if we sold them on the open market, we wouldn't get $1 billion for them. And so right there, the Fed created $1 billion. And if you look at the Fed's balance sheet, I guess it would go up by, its assets would go up by $1 billion because Citibank now owes it $1 billion, and its liabilities would go up by $1 billion because now there's the extra reserves, and you know the excess reserves in the system would go up by $1 billion and so on. And then though, after the 30 days expired, Citibank would give $1 billion back, and you know, the loan would close, and then maybe the Fed would go to J.P. Morgan and do the same thing. And so technically there, the way you're counting it, you could say, oh, the Fed just created $2 billion. It created $1 billion that it gave to Citibank, and then it did create another $1 billion and gave to J.P. Morgan. But if you look at the Fed's balance sheet over that period, it never would have, from those two transactions, it's not like it would have been $2 billion higher, because it would have expanded and then contracted and expanded again. And so I think that's what's going on when people come up with these really big numbers, is they're adding up all the individual acts of money creation, not what's the net over the whole period, because a lot of those individual things expired, and then you know that money was destroyed temporarily before they recreated it to give to somebody else. So I think that's the big picture answer, but I don't know what the specific numbers would be. Because yeah, if you look at, because I ran into this problem too, if you look for example at the chart of excess reserves, it went from you know being basically zero before the crisis to now it's something like 1.5 trillion, something like that. And it's not like it ever got, it never broke 2 trillion by any stretch. It didn't come close. And so when people loosely throw out, oh, the Fed's created trillions of dollars, you could say, well, wait a minute, how could it have? The most it could have created, but again, it's that same trick of, if they create it and give it to somebody, but then when that gets spent back to the Fed, then technically it disappears. Right, Costell, I noticed you weren't just... Costell tells us that a certain dictator with a mustache was smart, and he wanted to clarify that that was in response to me saying the guys at Harvard and MIT are smart. He wasn't just randomly announcing to the world that he thought the dictator of Germany was a smart guy because he felt like he knew to get that out there. Okay, let's see. We're running out of time, and actually now we got lots of questions, so let me make sure I don't miss anybody's question. Costell says, how could a libertarian politician convince 51% of people who vote but pay zero taxes that it's not a good idea to progressively tax the other 50%, or presumably the other 49%. How can you break this spell of majority dictatorship? You know, that's tricky. I'm running into this. I'm doing a project with this libertarian group out of Canada. And they're, because I'm a consultant, I don't know if you guys know that, but I don't teach at a university. I'm an idea entrepreneur or a hustler, depending on your viewpoint. And so right, one of my latest projects is I'm doing this, like I said, this group in Canada, they're trying to, you know, they're like a nonprofit up there, and they're trying to steer the public policy debate towards freer markets in Canada. And so one of the things they're cautioning about is with the tax code up there, they're saying don't go down the path that the United States went down, where we had this thing called the Earned Income Tax Credit, the EITC. And there what happens is if you make a certain amount, how does it work? I mean, I'm just going to give the big picture because I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head. But the idea is if you're in the United States right now, if you make a very low income, then you can get you can claim a tax credit. And so you can say, hey, you know, I have a job, but I only make under, you know, I make $6,000 a year, let's say. Well, then you're eligible for this thing called the Earned Income Tax Credit, and you can write it down. So it's a tax credit. A credit means, so the difference between a deduction and a credit, a tax deduction means that portion of your income that's deducted, you take it away and so the government's not taxing you on it. So it's as if you didn't earn that money. So it's not being taxed. But a tax credit means when all is said and done and you figure out how much you think you're supposed to write in a check to the IRS, you subtract it. All right. So a tax credit is much more lucrative than a deduction because the credit actually knocks off the amount you owe the government, where the deduction just takes away your, you know, the amount that's being taxed. So the EITC, it allows these people, if they qualify, to subtract from their actual tax bill, but beyond that, it's refundable. So if the number turns out negative, then the IRS sends you a check. And so, and I was just stunned by the numbers that there are, you know, there's, so it's not merely in terms of the income tax code, it's not merely that the upper income earners shoulder a disproportionate burden of it, which is, you know, what Costa's talking about here, but it's even worse than that is that the lower income earners are actually making money off of the income tax. You know, they actually get checks on net sent to them from the government. And so it's a really perverse thing when you run the numbers and just see the distributions of it. And as you say, Costa, that's the argument that we make in this paper, that it's really hard to how could you possibly get people to support shrinking the government when the method by which you pay for all these so-called government services, you're not paying for yourself, and in fact, you're actually making money off of it. That, you know, you're actually, you know, getting a check via the income tax. So, but the tension is, you know, and it's tricky, is that some people are going to take that analysis and say, so that's why we need to raise taxes on poor people. You know, so that they have skin in the game, and it's, you know, it's a fine line. I mean, so clearly, the way the system is right now in the United States is not good, either from like a general fairness perspective or a libertarian strategy perspective, that you're not going to be able to shrink the government if you've got huge percentages of the population who aren't on the margin really paying that much for it, or at least they don't perceive that they are. But it's tricky. You know, how do you get around that? Because some people want to say, oh, so that's why, you know, we should have a flat tax or something, and then make just tax everyone the same, and then people will realize there's no, you know, they won't want to grow the government because they're going to have to pay for it proportionally too. But then, I mean, what you're saying is the way to shrink government is to have the government start taxing, taking more money from certain segments of the population, and that's tricky to do that. You know, it's kind of analogous to anti-war people who want to bring back the draft, because they say, oh, right now the reason the politicians are so cavalier about sending U.S. troops abroad to go fight and die overseas is that it's not their kids that are going. It's, you know, just poor minority kids that are going. I'm generalizing, but that's what the people will say. And so nobody cares about that, or, you know, the people who care are, you know, the poor minorities who don't have any political clout. And so the way, you know, if you really wanted to keep the U.S. government from starting so many wars or from dabbling in so many foreign adventures, you have every family have skin in the game, and to have a draft where all these lawyers and doctors know that their kid might have to go fight, and then all of a sudden you'd see support for these wars drop pretty fast. So I understand the logic of that argument, but I think that's horrible. But no, you don't want to institute a draft and send people, you know, innocent people to go get killed just because you hope strategically that means the government will be less likely to do this. So by the same token, it's really tricky that yeah, certainly the current tax code, the structure where the upper income earners pay way more than the lower people do. Again, I'm talking about income taxes, because poor people pay a lot in sales taxes and they have withholding from in Social Security and Medicare and all that. So it's not like the government actually doesn't tax poor people. The government taxes the heck out of poor people. It's just we're talking here about the income tax per se. You know, it's even though you can agree it's bad whether the upper people are being taxed a lot more, it's tricky because that argument or that observation in the modern political context leads a lot of people to say, oh, okay, that's why then we need to just tax poor people too, as opposed to, you know, really what we want is don't tax anybody. So I don't know how to answer your question. I'm not really answering your question. I just would say I think what you need to do is convince people to not want government services. That when we, because that's the thing. I mean, that's always the stumbling block when you argue with people about, well, gee, we have this humongous deficit. How are we going to get out of it? And people will always say stuff like, well, you can't just do it through tax cuts, or you can't just do it through spending cuts, because there's always, you know, social services. It's got to be a balance. Yeah, sure, there's some government waste. We got to cut back on that, but we also need, you know, the rich to step up to the plate and contribute. But the whole thing driving that is they assume government spending is good, and it's just a trade-off between, oh, yeah, well, we can't tax people too much because then it has bad economic incentives, you know. So they think it's a trade-off, whereas, of course, a Rothbardian doesn't think it's a trade-off at all. The government spending by itself is a bad thing, and then when you tax people or borrow or inflate to finance it, that's a bad thing too. And so it's not, you know, it's a win-win if you move to in a direction where you're cutting government spending and cutting taxes. So I think, Costello, that really the only way to do it is if you convince more and more people to change their perspective as to what they think the role of government is in their lives. And it, you know, it's that as long as most people think that other things equal, the government helps you by spending money on your behalf, that there's really not going to be any way around this. Okay, well, I'll stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in, and I will see you on Wednesday.